Support for PrayPublic is provided by BNC National Bank, dedicated to providing financial solutions for businesses and consumers throughout the region. More information online at bnc.bank. And by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC, with a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and Northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513.
Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In the second half of today's show, we are bringing you part three from a compelling panel discussion at Concordia College featuring former North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp and former Governor Ed Schaefer. The event was titled With Malice Towards None and took place on April 23rd. And today, we'll hear questions that were asked from the audience on how the two politicians, one a Democrat and one a Republican, responded. But first, I'm with my co-host, Ashley Thornburg, here in our studio. And Ashley, in the first part of the show today, we're going to talk about how sometimes people with high standards can get in their own way. And a favorite quote of mine from a colleague I used to work with was, analysis paralysis.
Right? Okay, I struggle with this. I'll have an idea, but I can't go from A to B because I want to go from A to Z. And frankly, I want to do it perfectly. And perfection in place of progress. Yeah, that's kind of a thing. Today I'm joined by intuitive business coach Michelle Vasicek, and we start by talking about a provocatively titled talk she recently gave. Michelle, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So a title like yours, pretty provocative, Embrace Good Enough and Get... I don't know if the FCC will allow me to say your title, so I'll just say stuff. It's a different S word. Get stuff done. What do you mean by that?
So this actually came up in the context of helping my friend Melissa with the FM Wellness Collective. And so I'm a business coach, and I do sales and marketing strategy for small to businesses, right? So this is all under the context of that, but I will say that life is one arena, right? So this is applicable to all areas of life. So if you're not in sales and marketing or a business owner, just use this as a metaphor for other areas of your life, right? So I was helping her, and she's got an event coming up during the Fargo Marathon Week, FM Wellness Week. And she's like, okay, I've got my vendor proposal, my sponsorship proposal. What's next? And I was like, well, if you find somebody that wants to be a sponsor, a vendor, do you have a way to take their information and take their money? No. It's like, then that's our next step, right? So I asked her, I was like, what do we need to do to implement this? And she went on this whole long tirade of, okay, I already purchased the domain, fmwellnessweek.com, and I need to get the payment processor set up and create a form and do this and do that. And there was this whole long list that just made me feel overwhelmed just listening to it, right? I'm not even one that has to implement this.
Yeah.
And so I asked her, you know, is there a way that you could streamline this or make it easier and make it good enough for right now? And she said, yeah, actually, I already have the domain and the form and the payment processor and bank account and everything set up for the FM Wellness Collective. So I could just do the forms and the payment on that site. Mm. And, you know, do you think anybody's going to care if the domain's different? I was like, no, of course not. You know what I mean? And so it ended up sparking this whole conversation, right, at the collective that's, you know, especially those of us that are visionaries and we have big ideas and high standards and expectations of what's possible. We feel like we need to jump from zero to perfection. And sometimes that holds us back.
Why are you pointing at me, Michelle?
And this is, yeah, very much from my own experiences too, right? And I'll get stuck in this procrastination loop, right? Where it's like, then I don't do anything because I can't do it perfectly.
Yeah.
And it's this black and white thinking.
Yeah.
Right? So sometimes, you know, we can do things good enough for now, and maybe we can do another iteration later and improve on it when we have more time or more capacity or somebody to help us,
mm-hmm.
or the money to hire somebody to help us in our businesses, right? But for now, sometimes we need to do things good enough, right? So it's like there's stages. It's like, stage zero, actually, right, is stuff that's either not set up yet, it doesn't exist, or mm-hmm. it's broken and it doesn't work. And those are the things that we need to triage
mm-hmm.
and take care of first, because they're completely stopping the flow of
yeah.
things.
In a hot second, I'm just going to ask you straight up what a business coach is and does. But before that, even in your capacity as a business coach, just listening to what you said, how much of your life is listening to other people's verbal diarrhea and just picking up the one or two things that they need to focus on?
I mean, that's a lot of what I do. That's a lot of what I do, right? Is there's
yeah.
there's strategy, but there's also the, you know, I call it mindset work,
mm-hmm.
where it's shifting our perspective on things. Right? So we're still accomplishing the same thing, but we're looking at it from a different perspective. Right.
Mm-hmm. So what is a business coach and who needs one?
I mean, personally, I think everybody who owns a business or is self-employed could benefit from a business coach. And there's different seasons, right? So there's different business coaches that have different strengths and different things that they can offer. And so somebody that's in a startup stage and, you know, or versus somebody who's doing maybe e-com versus some kind of services that they offer and are trying to book out their calendar, right? Like different coaches are going to have different areas of expertise that
mm-hmm.
they're familiar with. But generally, it's doing things like this. It's like listening to the verbal diarrhea. I love how you put it. And then, you know, being able to have that more objective perspective on things and call us out on our shit and give us the tough love if we need to, or be able to help us see things from a different perspective, because
mm-hmm.
we get so caught up in our own minds and things, it's hard to see things from more objectively on it. And I'm the same way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm great at doing this for other people. I'm not great at doing it for myself.
Right.
I need help.
Is it kind of like proofreading your own work? You cannot see your own blind spots?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay. We're visiting today with Michelle Vasacek. She is an intuitive business coach. And, okay, that brings us to the next word here. Intuitive.
Yes.
What does that mean in the coaching world?
It seems like people really tend to lean towards intuition and emotions and the touchy-feely people, or they tend to lean towards the logic and the data and analytics and rationality,
mm-hmm.
right? And really, what we need is a combination of the two, somewhere
both
in the middle.
And?
Yes. But most of us have a tendency to lean towards one side or the other and are uncomfortable with or unfamiliar with or have a hard time
mm-hmm.
seeing the other side of things.
Yeah.
Right? So really what I do, I say I'm an intuitive business coach, but really what I do is I bring the intuition and I merge it with the strategy, right? Because a lot of us might think that marketing and sales stuff is witchcraft. It's not. It's strategy. Lots of people that aren't familiar with it, because it looks, you know, if you don't understand something, you know, whether it's technology or a skill set or things like that, like if you see, you know, an artist creates something, it kind of looks like magic.
I can see that, sure.
Right? But really, it's just that they have a skill set that they've built up over time and they've learned how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So same thing with marketing, is it's strategy and it's a skill set that can be learned. Now, there's also a lot of not helpful strategy and offers out there too. So that's part of it, is being able to discern through the helpful advice and the relevant stuff and figuring out what works for your business and your company, rather than, oh, this strategy worked for somebody else, so it should work for me too. Or this strategy worked for, you know, a big business or a corporation, it's going to work for my little solopreneur business too. Like, you're more than likely going to have a completely different strategy.
Is a word like intuitive in your title an effort to attract the kind of client that you want?
Ooh, yes. That is what we call polarization.
Because I can see a lot of people going, intuitive business coach, I don't know, that's witchcraft, or that sounds woo-woo. Or even, I suspect more of your clients might be female?
Generally speaking, yes.
Yeah, and that's, you know, the gut feeling. Women tend to be a little bit more okay with leaning into a gut feeling. And also, so much of our own survival is kind of based on, I have a good feeling about this or I have a bad feeling about this. And so we are more practiced in that versus the has to be, you know, repeatable, demonstrable by certain specific number. Like, I'm getting bored even saying it that way.
Yeah, so the interesting part is, like, generally I work with men too, but generally women, and they are in touch with their intuition and they don't understand the strategy and the analytics and that side of things. So what I'm bringing is, you know, being able to acknowledge the intuitive side of things and bring in the strategy and the skill set and the rational thinking, but in a way that feels aligned and not yucky or feeling like manipulative or coercing in any way, because there is a lot of marketing tactics and strategy out there that is manipulative. And I'm finding that a lot of women don't want to use that stuff in their businesses because it feels yucky.
Can you give me an example?
Good example is like high pressure sales, right? And so, you know, using these, I mean, people will do like NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, to do sales and marketing and like try to manipulate people to buy things and do what they want. And all this can be used for good or evil, right? But like on a high pressure sales call, they're using manipulation tactics and trying to get people, oh, if you don't have the money, get a credit card. Can you borrow it from your parents? Can you take out a loan? Here's a link to a funding company that you can apply for, and trying to strong arm people and pressure them into doing something that maybe isn't the most aligned step for them in the moment. And it's very forceful. And it seems that, you know, a lot of women don't even want to do, you know, they're scared to even like ask for a $50 deposit or, you know,
ask for what they need.
Like, that's uncomfortable enough to like ask to get paid for the services that they're offering.
Yeah, I wonder how much of your work is, in a lot of ways, a kind of therapy. To do the work of convincing, in particular, a woman, but not exclusively, to get paid what they're worth. Factor in woman, factor in Midwest. Girl, this is a Sisyphean task.
Yeah, because it's, you know, and we want to, especially, you know, what I'm seeing is like wellness practitioners and people that offer kind of more of those holistic services. Like, we want to help people, right? And at the same time, we live in this capitalistic society where we have bills that we need to pay. There's children's mouths that need to be fed. We can't just go offer all of our services for free. You know, so that's another thing that, you know, there's a couple different people I've been talking to, and they're setting up scholarship funds and different ways that people can access these services. And the practitioners still get reimbursed for it so that it's win-win.
I remember seeing a chart one time that took a wife and a mother and the tasks that she was doing every day and totaled out how much would you pay if you had to hire out each of these services independently. And I'll just say it was very close to triple my annual salary. And yep. It's things that I would never think to charge for. And that's just life, not as a business person.
Yeah, that's just the stuff at home, let alone if you have a business and you're offering services to people. Yeah.
I want to go back to the speech that you were giving at the FM Wellness Collective meeting about embracing good enough in order to get stuff done. It does imply that there's something wrong with perfection. Is that a fair assessment?
No, and two things here. One is that like true perfection is completely unattainable, right? And even if you manage to get something in a perfect state for a moment, something's going to happen, right? So I think, you know, like if we take perfection in a literal sense, yes, that is unrealistic and unattainable. That being said, going back to like those of us that have, you know, big visions and big goals and high standards for things is going back to the stages, right? So we talked about like stage zero is something that's broken or non-existent, and that just needs to get something that's functional, right? So then level one, I kind of call that the duct tape stage, where it's like, let's say there's, a Reiki practitioner that's just starting their business.
And this is a Japanese healing art.
Yeah, it's energy healing. Okay. Yep. So let's say they want to start taking on clients because they just got their Reiki certification, their attunement, right? Okay, so maybe for now they can set up a PayPal account or Venmo so they can take payments, and then they'll set up a free Calendly account because, again, all of this is free, no cost. And then once somebody, they can send somebody the payment link to pay, and then they can send the free Calendly link to book, right? And that's functional. It's good enough. There's some friction there, right? And it's maybe not the most professional looking thing, but it works, right? And then, you know, maybe the next stage or the stage above that is having something like an Acuity is a scheduling system that I'm familiar with, where you can embed that into your website and it'll collect the customer's payment. It'll automatically give them your calendar so they can schedule their session that's integrated with your Google Calendar so it knows your availability. It has email and text message reminders. They can reschedule their appointment if something comes up, and then it also can take care of all of the intake paperwork all in one system. So it's a lot more automated and integrated and takes away a lot of that friction and a lot more of those manual tasks off of your plate, which you need when you're scaling up and getting busier.
Yeah.
But that also takes more money and time and skills to implement.
Yeah. Let's talk about the impact of that, though, on what they call mental energy or your creative energy. There are some people, one of the things you see on those 7 habits of highly effective people or that kind of thing is like, I eat the same thing for breakfast every day. I wear the same thing. And the argument there is they don't want to, quote unquote, waste their mental energy on a decision that maybe doesn't matter all that much. And then why do they say that? What happens if you start to mechanize certain routines and habits?
Yeah, so like when you start to set up systems and automations and be able to delegate things, that exactly you said, it frees up your time so that you can do what you intended to do. Because again, most of these, like let's take a service practitioner, the Reiki person, they didn't sign up to like want to run a business or do marketing or like all of these systems, right? They want to go help people. So if you can spend more of your time on things like that as a business owner rather than doing the operations and logistical things, you have more impact, which is what people want to do.
We're visiting today with Michelle Vasacek. She is an intuitive business coach. And I wasn't anticipating this conversation going in this direction, but I've kind of wondered about AI and some of the tools that you are talking about, even just like the Calendly, like send someone a link and then it books directly into each of their calendars instead of like the back and forth. Does this time work for you versus this
exactly.
and that? And I feel like is it fair to say that it's kind of leveling the playing field for female business owners? Because so much of that work, when there have been male CEOs, they got to sub all that out to women.
Yes.
And now all of a sudden, we can sub that out?
Yeah. Yeah. The executive assistant role or secretaries. Yep.
Yeah.
And the thing, too, is it makes it more accessible to more people because generally the AI solutions are more affordable than committing to hiring somebody for a certain number of periods. And that being said, there's still, virtual assistants that you can contract on a part-time basis. So that can be really accessible, too.
Mm-hmm.
But again, if you're a business owner and you're bootstrapping it and just starting out, you've got a slim budget. So you need to be really strategic about how you're spending that.
Yeah. Well, can you give us, you mentioned Calendly, and I don't want to lock you into this is the only one to use for that, but can you give us maybe 5 or 10 of, maybe you don't have to use brand name resources here, mm-hmm. but a couple that are just like, if you just need a graphic designed to get you the website and then you're going to work with a graphic designer, like that kind of, what are some of the resources out there?
Ooh, that's a good question. It's really going to depend on what industry you're in and what kind of business you have, because there's going to be different things that are geared towards everybody, right? But if, going for service-based practitioners, which is mostly those smaller businesses I'm working with that are really, it's one person.
Yeah.
They don't have an assistant. They don't have a whole team working behind them. They don't have a huge budget. Setting up something like Calendly for scheduling or, Acuity or anything like that. And then having, I personally like WordPress for websites because it's really affordable and you can, if you get an SEO-friendly theme.
Search engine optimization.
Yes, thank you. It can be pretty straightforward to use if you, put a little research and effort into it. But other people, prefer websites like Wix or things like that. I feel like they're overpriced for what they're worth. But, if that's what you're familiar with and you like it, like whatever is going to get it done, right? If something feels like it's not resonating or it's too hard or it just doesn't work, then it's not worth trying to force yourself into that box.
How did you end up as a business coach?
That's a good question. So I actually started out doing nutrition coaching and tarot readings and Reiki and I paused that during COVID because I couldn't meet with people in person.
Yeah.
But the whole time during that, I've had a full-time career in sales marketing and client support. And it was always that mindset of like, this is just my day job and like really my passion is, the woo-woo stuff. And one day I'll be able to take my business full-time and quit my job. And then I kind of had this revelation a couple years ago and from talking to friends. And they have these businesses that they want to run and they need the sales and marketing strategy that I've been learning over the last, it's been more than a decade now in my career. And so I was like, I need to merge, the intuitive woo-woo side of things with the sales and marketing strategy and make that accessible and say it in a way that's relatable and understandable for regular people.
Intuitive business coach Michelle Vasacek. You can find out more at lunawolfsales.com. Michelle, thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ashley.
Still to come on Main Street, our third segment on civility from an event that was held earlier this month at Concordia College. That's after this.
Plains Art Museum in Fargo is hosting its Spring Gala 2024 Sci-Fi Artistry on Saturday, May 4th from 7 p.m. until midnight, featuring food, wine tasting, art auction, and dancing into the night to post-traumatic funk syndrome and Star 4. Proceeds benefit museum education and accessibility. More information and tickets at plainsart.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today, we bring you part three from a compelling panel discussion at Concordia College featuring former North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp, a Democrat, and former North Dakota Governor Ed Schaefer, a Republican. The event was titled With Malice Towards None and took place on April 3rd at Concordia College. Today, we'll hear questions that were asked of the candidates from the audience. The Q&A discussion was moderated by Dr. Sonia Wendling, Dean of the School of Arts and Sciences at Concordia College.
We would like to provide the audience with an opportunity to ask some questions as well.
So another image I have is the January 6th insurrection with three FBI agents with their pistols trying to hold back a wild mob who's taken over the Senate chambers. To me, that is a very disturbing image, and it's equal to the image I had at the top of the dike. I do believe there's kind of an attitude in our country that says if we don't agree with the procedures, the politics that are in place, we'll just take it over and we'll do it our way. So yeah, civic discourse and respect for leaders, I think, is at a low point in many cases. It's multiplied by how we fight politically and the ads that are prevalent today. So how do we turn that around? And I'm afraid of losing our democracy. I was listening to CNN and you called it out and you said, he's blowing a dog whistle to the various groups that are supporting him. And no other national leaders had that insight. And I really respect you for that insight that you have. And I'd really appreciate your comments.
My inspiration is people like Adam Kinzinger, like Mitt Romney, Richard Burr. I mean, I could go through all the people. I think there's been so much emphasis on the former president. We haven't had enough emphasis on the people who have aided and abetted by turning a silent ear towards that behavior. Right after the aftermath of January 6th, McConnell got up and said, this is horrible. He and Nancy were in the bunker together trying to figure out what they were going to do. I mean, and there was this kind of moment of unity until they saw some political consequence. And then it was like, you know, let's go down Speaker McCarthy. Let's go down and make sure that we're kissing the ring, if I can put it that way, and speaking to only an audience of one. And the rest of us saw what we saw. And there is a gaslighting in this country about what we saw. We saw what we saw. We saw what a leader who was supposed to unite the country and call it off, do nothing. I was on ABC during we were just supposed to do a quick spot about the certification, and we ended up being on all day. And I kept saying, why doesn't the president say something? Why isn't he calling this off? He's the only person that can, despite repeated calls. And we can say, was that deplorable? You know, I would tell you, I think it was deplorable. I think that it was a horrible moment in our history. But the people I fault are the people who, in spite of what they experienced that day, in spite of the fear that they had, now come back and stand with that person. How does that happen? Yes. And so it goes back to rewarding the good guys. And unfortunately, guess what the good guys are doing? They're quitting because it's too hard. I told students, I said, we're here to try and get you not to step back or run away, but to step up, because that's the only thing that's really going to solve this problem long term.
I don't have much to add. I think it was awful. But I think the difficulty is, as Heidi mentioned, people who should be standing up and say it was wrong and did stand up and say it was wrong, all of a sudden saying, you know, it's not their fault, or they were incited, or they, you know, didn't really
they were
break,
tourists.
They didn't really break down the door, you know, when we all see it. To me, that's the most difficult thing and hard for me to understand, is how people don't stand up for the right. One of the tenets in our governor's office was do the right thing. You know, and doing the right thing isn't excusing people pounding on the doors and going through and sitting on the speaker's desk and ripping up papers and tearing up our Capitol. It's deplorable. And unfortunately, leadership is not standing up to it. Leadership is succumbing to this money thing and fame thing and whatever's going on out there with President Trump. It's a situation that's causing us to kind of turn away from the truth and turn away from doing what's right, because people that should be are not standing up to say this is what's right.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. First, I'd like to say that I'm a state senator in North Dakota, and that in the North Dakota Senate last session, 70% of all our votes were unanimous. And it's the invisible system that works that no one sees. When things work, you don't notice. You only notice the conflict. And so with young people and with students, it's important to watch and be in the room so that you see that much of governance actually works. My concern about the anti-politics and the disengagement of the citizens is it's become an anti-government feeling. The government is the problem. If we didn't have government, there's a really strong, not just the political tone, but the anti-government at all. Bills to eliminate all child welfare. Those are the things that worry me, and I think there's an underlying distrust of all government, and I'd appreciate your comments on that.
Well, Kathy, thanks for your question. I apologize for the quip about legislators. I think Kathy's right. You know, there is a mistrust of our government. And here's what I'll give you a quick comment about why, and I'll give you maybe what could be a solution. So when we have this political campaigning going on where each candidate is telling the other one they're a liar and they're awful and they're terrible and they should never serve and their character is the worst in history, you know, those kinds of things, both candidates are going back and forth, and we see it all the time. What does a high school student think today? No matter who gets elected, they're bad. We are shaping our government to be bad. We're shaping the image of government to be irresponsible and difficult and ne'er-do-wells that are leaders. That's a wrong thing to do. Government should be good. Government should be capable. And we should look to our government for inspiration and hope and character. And we don't. So here's one possible solution, and I think I've talked to Jack Zaleski about it before, but I think there needs to be a quick tribunal of truth in place, and the National Advertisers Association. If you put a commercial on air, on radio or on television, your competitor can challenge that to say whether it's truth or not. If you're comparing your product to someone else's, you can say, hey, that's not true. And the people who belong to that association say, if that's judged and that's challenged and judged to be wrong, you can't show it anymore, or you've agreed not to show it anymore or play it anymore. I think you need that in politics. I think we need that standard bearer that says, I can challenge that. They're saying, call me a liar, or I didn't vote that way, or I did do this or that. There's got to be that tribunal that stands up and says, wait a minute, it's got to be quick and fast because they're going to do it in the last minute, right? I think you need to have that public standard that you can turn to that says, no, this is right, that's wrong. And the advertisers and the media and the political pundits or whatever have to abide by the decision.
I think that when you look at how we talk about government, think about this. Today in Haiti, there is no government. People are living in terror of what might happen. There is horrible things happening to families and just innocent people in Haiti because there's no government. And we have so taken for granted our rule of law, our economic system that was only possible because we have rule of law, because we have, you know, courts that where you can adjudicate your contract claims. We have equated government as something bad because we have not experienced a world where there is no government. When you look across the globe and see what does it look like if you don't fund the fire department? What does it look like if you're drawing water out of a river where cows are swimming right next to it and there's no water filtration system? Do you want to live in a country that does that? Do you want to live in a country where anyone can send you a pill and there's no FDA to say whether that's legitimate? Now, you may say it's gone too far, but we haven't talked about the basic benefits that we enjoy as citizens because of government. And Byron Dorgan used to do something when people would come and, you know, damn the government when he was talking. He would say, you know, when I think about the government, I think about the law enforcement officer who responded to my mother's fatal accident and what he saw and how he tried to help her. That's the government. So I just don't criticize the government. And so not enough of us personalize the benefit that we get. Even if we're not getting public assistance, we are getting a rich benefit from the system that we live in. And it's only possible because we live in this country and we have government.
Thank you to Concordia and to all the sponsors for doing this. We need to have this conversation and we need to spotlight the idea of civility, so I appreciate you doing that. And I've recently joined the board of the center, the National Institute for Civil Discourse, which is all about this. And by the way, it was founded by former presidents Bush the Elder and Clinton, who ran against each other and later became friends and realized we needed civility in politics. So a couple things real quickly. One is I want to second what Kathy said about the North Dakota legislature, because although I will say it's getting more divisive, more vitriol than I ever saw years before. A couple of years ago when I was Speaker of the House, I sponsored a bill and asked a former opponent of mine on the other side of the aisle, who was then in the legislature as well, to be a co-sponsor on an issue that was not political, that everyone could agree with, and it passed unanimously in the House and the Senate. And finding common ground, I guess is the way I would put it, rather than compromise. Now, you talked a lot about compromise, so one of my two thoughts that I'd like you to expound upon, the question of compromise, I love what Thomas Jefferson once said. He said, on matters of style, swim with the currents. On matters of principle, stand like a rock. And I think that's what you were getting at earlier, Ed, about not compromising your principle. And I think, Heidi, you seconded that idea. So that's what I've tried to sort of live by. But the idea of civility being coming together and finding common ground rather than necessarily compromising on things that you hold dear. Second question is, I find as we talk about this that people assume that people that are willing to talk about civility and engage in it, in government, in politics, are middle of the roaders. In other words, they're either left-leaning Republicans or right-leaning Democrats. And I don't think that's true. It shouldn't be true. Because I think people can stand with their convictions and be as liberal or conservative as they are and still regard others with respect and esteem and find ways to work together where they can and disagree respectfully where they can't. I love what my friend, our mutual friend, Ed, Mike Huckabee, once said. He said, I'm a conservative, I'm just not mad about it. And I love that. And that's how I've tried to live and to govern. So on those ideas, I just appreciate you being here, and I appreciate your further thoughtful comments.
One of the things that I found in delivering the office, I did make the comment, you know, that we're moving around here on not compromising, but as you said, you don't have to compromise your principles. You can allow other principles in. You can allow the opportunity to craft part of your principles and part of somebody else's for what's good for the common good. I don't think the conversation should be, boy, you have to compromise to make this happen. You incorporate the different views and the different sides to make it happen. Being a governor is a small fraternity, but there were three former governors to me that were active in the campaign against me. right? And so when I was running, you know, we were dealing with that. After I was elected and after the politics was over, and you're talking about governing and turning for advice and talking to people about that are experienced and capable, two of those governors became very good and close friends. The other one became friendly, you know. And I think that's the point of all this is it isn't about politics. It isn't about personal philosophy. It really is serving the people and representing the people out there to craft the direction of society and culture in our country. And that's hugely important to be able to incorporate other values and character as you're doing that.
I would just add, civility is not something that happens organically. It has to be practiced. Just like character has to be practiced every day. You have to think about the morality of the decisions you make or the morality of your behavior. You know, it's not like, everybody by nature is good and they've now decided to do something mean. No, the positive action is being civil. And so I would just say that civility is a practiced muscle memory. And once you start doing it, and once you start making it part of your value system, your behavior will change. But you've got to convince people to practice it every day. If you're an elite athlete, right, you practice every day. If you're a smart kid and you want to, you know, go to, you know, an elite school, or you want to come here to Concordia, I mean, you got to get the grades, you're going to study. But we never ask people to practice their character, and civility is part of that character. So we've got to make that part of our daily affirmations, our daily practice, to try and be as civil as we can be.
And part of civility that Heidi and I have had over time is some happiness and fun, by the way. You know, if we get too serious, we get like, this is going to change the world if this doesn't happen or does happen. And I have to tell you, and we told a story earlier today a couple of times, but when we were in the midst, we were campaigning for different offices, but our political parties obviously were campaigning against each other. We ended up at the same event one time in the middle of the campaign. And we had young staff with us, and everybody's, you know, kind of going back and forth when they're on stage. But afterwards, we got to talking. We took the staff and went bowling, right? And after bowling, we went to the bar next door and did karaoke.
It's a true story.
You know? Yeah. And so, you know, think of the kids that were there. You know, it was fun, it was happy, it was difficult and hard work, but you know, you gotta have some fun along the way and you gotta be happy about the whole thing. Carry some joy in what we're doing here.
I just wanna tell, I don't keep a lot of memorabilia just because you get overwhelmed with plaques. Now, if you've ever given me a plaque, I've always appreciated it. But, you know, eventually you don't want it. I have one thing that I keep in my drawer in my office, and it's a Groucho Marx, a set of glasses and a nose and the mustache. And you might wonder, where did I get that? Well, when I was running for governor, Ed was retiring because he had done two terms. When I was running for governor, they were going to come in and do a filming and the Industrial Commission meeting, and Ed was going to be there. So Ed showed up with the Groucho Marx costume on, so he wouldn't appear in any of my commercials. I said, all you had to do, Ed, was just paint your mustache a little dark. You didn't need to get the big nose thing. But it's something I treasure because it was lighthearted. It was funny. It wasn't, you know, him going to camera saying, can you believe she's here? She wants to use my image, blah, blah, blah. He just had fun with it. And I think that, I don't know, the old days of those kind of political pranks and that kind of funness, I think fun's gone out of the business of politics, and that's a big problem. Ed's right.
My question is for you guys who both have been very partisan actors for each political party, your thoughts or critiques on the state of your own parties today, as I see a lot of the solutions you guys are coming up with are engagement, people being involved and being part of the process. Well, at the same time, the parties are seem to be becoming much more narrow in who they'll allow in or, be allowed to be part of that process. So if people are interested and engaged, to try and find solutions, but also being excluded by the parties that are the means to do that. What are the answers, and what kind of solutions you might have for those issues?
Yeah. From the Republican Party standpoint in North Dakota, what I would say is Republicans have been in office too long.
I agree.
And not because Republicans don't perform in delivering, but here's what I'm talking about. So in North Dakota today, if you have an R behind your name, you're likely going to get elected. What has happened is because people know that Republicans have become complacent. They don't show off their means because it doesn't matter. My candidates are going to get elected anyway. They don't get involved in campaigning door to door because they don't, and my candidates are going to get elected anyway. And so as Republicans have become disengaged in the process or become complacent and not worrying about it, they don't show up. And so the people who have showed up in the Republican Party today are the noisy ones, the culture warriors, the steamers and the fist wavers about we have to correct this and we have to do that or history's going to change. You know, we really need to get this done. And I say that is the, I'd like the Republicans to stay in longer, but the point is, you know, we as a party, with members of the party, with people who claim they're Republicans, are not standing up. They're not engaging. They're not voting. They're not putting forth candidates. They're not writing checks. They're not supporting because they don't have to.
Those were excerpts from the With Malice Towards None panel discussion that was held at Concordia College, featuring former North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp and former North Dakota Governor Ed Schaefer. You can hear all three of the segments that we've brought to you here on Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org. Our thanks to Candace Harmon, the Media Relations and Communications Strategist at Concordia College, for working with us to provide this audio for our listeners. Dakota Datebook is ahead.
The Minot Symphony Orchestra presents the 98th season finale with Our Town, Saturday, April 27th at MSU's Anacol Nelson Hall. This performance includes the world premiere of The Four Seasons in North Dakota, written by Maestro Amaya, plus a film experience where live orchestral music is paired with a big screen cinematic experience. More information can be found online at minotsymphony.com or by phone at 701-858-4228.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Today's Dakota Datebook for April 23rd. Yesterday, we told you about Heber Creel's efforts to gain control of the land on the north shore of Devil's Lake as the railway headed in that direction. Creel and his cronies used every tactic, legal or not, to make sure they would make a tidy profit if the railroad bought their claims. Two brothers from Chicago had discovered that one of Creel's men illegally straddled two claims with his claim shack. John Bell had legal claim to only one of the parcels, so 23-year-old Fred Ward put up a shanty on the other. At 2 a.m. on April 22nd, shots were heard at the shanty. Both Fred and his brother, Charlie, were found dead. Jack Elliott, who was also at the shanty, was badly beaten. He told authorities that a group of men surrounded the shanty and told them to leave, but when Fred opened the door, he was promptly dragged off and beaten. Charlie reportedly yelled into the dark, asking if his brother was okay. There was no answer, so he fired his revolver from the window. The answer was a volley of rifle fire until he yelled that he gave up. When Charlie walked out, he was shot in the neck. The men who took part in the killings arrogantly admitted they did it, calling it a case of claim jumping. Charges were filed against him, and a trial was held 15 months later. The victim's father, Dr. Ward, sent a heavy hitter from Chicago to work with prosecutors. Of the dozen men charged with the crime, the two with the most evidence against them were tried first. One had admitted that he dropped to a knee and carefully sighted before shooting Charlie Ward. There were several such damaging statements, and the prosecution was optimistic, but both men were acquitted. And in a bizarre twist, the prosecutors then told the judge that if they couldn't convict these two, they couldn't convict any of them. An impartial jury could not be found. The judge agreed and dismissed the remaining cases. John Bell and several others next tried to preempt the deceased brother's land claims. And the only justice he received, Dr. Ward took the case on behalf of the heirs. He won, and his son's killers were evicted. 3 months after the killings, The railroad reached Heber Creel's self-titled town, and it was renamed Devil's Lake. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Mary Helm. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful to share this time with you. Just a reminder, tonight at 7 o'clock, a debate. The Republican gubernatorial primary candidates are debating, and you can hear all of that discussion on the platforms of Prairie Public. Tomorrow on the show, actually, an important discussion of something that rings important to me, being from Wyoming. It's about Matthew Shepard.
Right. He was murdered 25 years ago this past October, and Concordia College has spent the academic year exploring the legacy of his death. He was murdered because of his homosexuality. There's a stage performance, there is a choral work, there is a sculpture piece here exploring pain, but also the ability to heal through the arts.
It's an important topic, and yeah, it's wonderful that Concordia College is presenting this information. We hope you can join us again tomorrow here on Main Street.